All right, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleisher Show, broadcasting from Jerusalem to the world, and you're a part of it wherever you are. Right now, I'm in beautiful Beit Midrash Sulam Yaakov in the heart of Jerusalem in Nachlaot. And you know what that means? That means I'm with Rabbi Mike Foyer. Rabbi Mike, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Yishai. It's great to be here.
And of course, that means we're on Spiritual Cafe, which we examine and get into the feelings and the meanings of the Torah portion. This week, it's Parshat Vayishlach, filled with tremendous dramatic events, the changing of the name of Jacob to Israel, from Yaakov to Israel, the great fight for the city of Shechem, the great meeting between Jacob and the angel, Esav's angel potentially, maybe a meeting with himself, and also the actual meeting with the dude, your brother, which you stole the birthright, you took the birthright from and stole the blessings from. And he's a man of war, you're a man of peace, and the meeting eyeball to eyeball. So very intense stuff. But before we go on to that, I just want to say first that the Yishai Fleisher Show will soon be part of thelandofisrael.com, Land of Israel Network. Very excited for that. And you can hear our show at jewishpress.com and also at on iTunes and on SoundCloud. Great stuff. And I want to thank Moshe Herman, who I don't thank enough for helping make this show possible and putting it, getting it to all those different places. Rabbi Mike, we are in the continuation of a terror wave here in Israel, which has taken the lives of yet more people since we haven't seen each other for, I think, 2 weeks. This is and many Jews have been killed, murdered in horrific fashion in the meantime. Including in Tel Aviv while they were praying, including at the Gush Junction, an American yeshiva student, Ezra Schwartz, was killed, and then they had a funeral for him in America, which I watched live. A young lady was stabbed, I heard in different parts of the body, but the bottom line is that she was just a beautiful young lady, was just murdered in the prime of her life, 21-year-old. Lots of tough stuff. Israel continues to thrive. People are in the cafes and so forth. We have not gone into some kind of state of mourning. Still, though, I wonder sometimes, have we gone a little cold? Has the ISIS-like atmosphere that surrounds our region, not to mention the incredible World War III-esque tensions in Syria involving the Russians, and this is one of those things that has the Kabbalist people, you know, the Kabbalist voices out there.
Sure.
There's a ping that's coming out of the Kabbalist world. They're like, whoa, 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 this is it, this is it, this is it, watch out, there's Gog and Magog action here. And that's because something about Russia being in the Middle East has the Kabbalist folks, their antennae are vibrating right now.
Not to mention the security experts, because the very nature of the force alone, you don't even have to get mystical in order to see the potential for real destruction. But your question of whether we've gone cold, I think back to the Oslo War, which the rest of the world thinks of as the Second Intifada, right? And I'm sure you recall how quick Israel always was to, when a bus stop was bombed, it was like within hours, there was a new stop there. They cleaned up the glass, they cleaned up the mess, and everybody's going about their business. And people speak about resilience and the need to move on, to go on, and you can't let these things, you know, change your life. And there's truth to that. Lately, though, I've been thinking that it's not just resilience. It's a cover for actually dealing with the problem. Mm-hmm. So I think if we let ourselves bother it more, let this bother us more, if after these murders happened, we were actually shouting in the streets at our government and at each other saying, this can't go on. And I'm not even going to offer what the solution is. I don't really, that's not my issue right now. My issue is I feel like there's a certain, I don't know if it's coldness or fear. There's a fear of the enormity of what it would really take at this point to engage this problem in anything other than the piecemeal fashion that we're doing, which, you know, I the security forces are doing what they're being told, and they're doing it well. You can round up people, you can clamp down, you know, et cetera. But I feel like all that's just welding a lid on a boiling pot. At a certain point, it's going to blow again and even bigger. Whereas you got to take the pot off the stove, right? And again, I don't know if now is the time and place to discuss what that looks like, but I feel like that desire that things remain normal and not to let terror, you know, change our lives at a certain point becomes an excuse for action.
I think you said it very, very well, the enormity of the task before us. And there's a second enormity behind that. There's an enormous task. There's an enormous jihadist teaching that has infiltrated, really has gone, and we see now to where it has filtered down to the youngest of peoples who are willing to kill and be killed for their jihadist beliefs. So the enormity is great. The dispersion of this teaching is throughout this whole region and certainly here in Israel. But there's a yet another enormity behind that, and that is the enormity of the Jewish people taking their role and not hiding in a kind of simplistic nationalism where it's, you know, we're a country like all other countries. There's a fear here that actually taking up that enormous role of fighting the jihad also means, and it does, implicitly it means saying what we are, that we have rights, that we have historical rights, that we have biblical rights, that we are those people. And it's there's a logical domino effect, which is true, a slippery slope that actually leads you all the way to the big thing of, let's call it, I don't know, temple consciousness or whatever it is.
Absolutely. There's no question. And I would go one step further. It's not just about national rights and biblical rights. It's basically whether we're going to lead the world or going to become its whipping post again. And because it's not beyond imagination that everything that's happening in the world, be it the murders in Paris, be it, you know, what's happening in Syria, the world could turn around and say, it's the Jews' fault. And instead of, you know, marshaling itself to fight the jihad, they can very easily marshal themselves to fight us. Whereas there's also the potential for us to step up and stand our ground, reach inside ourselves and find the type of vision that we're capable of and say, no, this is what the world could look like and we're going to make it happen. But you're absolutely right that in a physical sense, that is pointing straight toward the Temple Mount. In a spiritual sense, it's pointing straight toward our task of bringing the presence of God back to earth.
So the encounter with the world is mimicking the biblical tale of the encounter of Esav and Yaakov. And basically, what we have in this week's Torah portion is the end of the exile for Yaakov and his family, which mirrors the end of the exile of the Jewish people. And the exile is kind of finished. He's done with his time with Laban. He makes his understanding with Laban. He crosses a certain Rubicon, comes into the land of Israel. And before you can inherit the land of Israel, you still have enemies to face within. And the first enemy is your older brother, Esau. And he is marching towards Yaakov with 400 men, which is a kind of... It's this gigantic army of you know, ISIS folks.
They're big red hairy men,
right? But they're ready to tear your flesh. They're ready yep. to pull out your jugular in a real sense. Like they're ready to decimate you. Totally. That's at least the feeling you get. Like,
well, that's how war was fought.
Right.
I mean, as much as we see ISIS as this horrible, terrible aberration, in many ways, they're just doing it old school. This is how historically war was fought. You know, it's only Europe after its exhaustion of 1,500 years of war that decided it needed to have rules. Before that, humanity fought war to destroy its enemy.
Right.
And by whatever means necessary.
Right.
I think there's a very important lesson in this meeting. I don't know if you're driving toward it, but it speaks to the state of fear that so many of us live in today. Because, you know, it's the Torah says...
The person who's going to feel that fear is Yaakov, and it's going to be very visceral.
And it's two-sided. And I think it opens up the question of what the trouble with finding our vision is. I'm looking now in the 32nd chapter of Genesis, the 8th line, because it says, Vayira Yaakov me'od vayetzer lo. Right? When he hears that Esau's coming with these 400 men, he's afraid, and it deeply troubled him. So all the commentators pick up on, like, what's the double language here? He's afraid, and it troubled him. And Rashi brings... a very simple but powerful explanation. He says that v'yira v'yetzer. He says v'yira. He was afraid. Shema yehareg. Right? Maybe he'll be killed. Natural. 400 guys and Esau, his mean brother. V'yetzer lo im yarog hu et acherim. He's also troubled by the fact that he may have to kill others. In and of itself, this is part of the moral dilemma we face as a people. Okay, we're afraid to die. That's a natural thing. But there's a deeper
problematic we feel is that we don't actually want to kill others. And when you look at the Or HaChaim HaKodesh, written, you know, a good 400, 500 years after Rashi, I think he opens out for us what was troubling. Yaakov didn't have any problem killing the enemy. We see this elsewhere, and we see it from his forefathers. And frankly, I think that that's part of morality. And the Torah says, right? Someone who comes to kill you, you should wake up early in the morning to kill them first. That is morality. But the Or HaChaim HaKodesh says, no. His problem was he didn't know whether Esau was really coming to kill him or to greet him. Now, he couldn't afford to leave his guard down. He was afraid to leave his guard down because what if he was coming to kill him? And yet he was troubled by the fact that he knew what if he kept his guard up and Esau was coming to actually make friends with him. And he sees, hey, look, Yaakov's ready for a fight. And then Esau switches into that battle position. That's our problem right now, is we're completely reactive. That's where the fear comes from. Is that, well, I have to position myself according to the way the world looks at me. Well, the world wants me to be passive, I'll be passive. If the world wants me to be active, I'll be active. And that's what's troubling Yaakov. Instead of just saying, listen, I have one job here, and this is to get my family back into the land of Israel, and I'm going to do that without fear. This is what we're not really doing today.
Well, the way I understand what you're saying is that when you have, just in general, and this is true about life and concentration in general, when you're at cross purposes, when you're not sure about what kind of stance to take or how to spend your time or how to prepare for this thing coming at you, is it friend or foe? You have to do it, and you know, you're kind of splitting up your energy and your thoughts, and he's concerned here. You're right. Is Esau friend or foe? Am I going to be killed or will I have to kill? And then the next line after that is that he literally vayachatz et ha'am. He's going to divide the nation that is with him. He's going to make he's going to hedge his bets. He's going to you know, split up the nation. He's going to divide them up right there. You get that sense of division, and then subsequently you're going to also see that when he has the famous wrestling match, mm-hmm. that our rabbis explain as a wrestle with the angel of Esav.
So who do you think he was wrestling with?
I think if you look at the verse, which is chapter 32, verse 25. Obviously, I accept the rabbinic interpretation, but another way of looking at it is that it says, "Vayvater Yaakov levado." Yaakov stayed by himself. Ve'avek ish imo. So he was by himself, but somebody was wrestling with him. But it says that he was by himself, meaning to say he's wrestling with himself, with an aspect of himself. He's having, he's having a psychological type episode. He's having a grappling with himself. It could very well be, let's not forget, he is a twin. He's a twin of Esau. So, you know, that twinning means that they, maybe you could say that both of them have a little bit of an aspect of the other, or that he's, you know, that part of him, that Esau part in him. But the bottom line is he's having some kind of struggle, which interestingly enough yields, he comes out of it injured.
Mm-hmm. And limping.
He's limping. And yet there's revelation, and that revelation is like a preview, a kind of, he forces this angel or this other or himself to also preview the new identity and new level that he's going to be reaching called Israel.
I mean, there's so much about names here at the end. Yaakov is holding him, and the angel, it's so unclear, by the way, when you look at the pronouns. He touched his leg, you know. And,
right, who's touching who?
Yeah, and then Yaakov is holding him, and he says, what's your name? So yeah, he answers Yaakov. So okay, now we can assume that Yaakov's answering. He says, no, Yaakov's not your name. It's Yisrael, right? And he says why, which we'll get to in a minute. And then Yaakov asks him back, but what's your name? And he said, why are you asking me my name? But you notice that once he says his name is Yisrael, Yaakov's name doesn't change. Right, that's the essence of this struggle, because Yaakov means to, like, you know, take the end run around things, like your heel is bent, right? And as Esav himself says way back in the Parsha or two ago, when Yaakov steals the bracha and you know, sort of like strong arms him out of the birthright, he's Akveni Zepamimi. He's done an end run around me twice. And Yisrael,
it's the heel. You're, it's the heel. He's always at the heel. He's always biting at the heel.
But it also literally means bent,
right?
Right? Oh, that's why the heel is called Ekev, because it's that part that, you know, is like a dog leg. Right? And Yisrael, with all the many meanings that it gets, the easiest reading is Yisrael, straight to God. And that's what Yaakov's struggling with. How do I go about this meeting? Should I try to pull a fast one on him again?
I'll send the presents.
Right.
I'll split up the nation. I'll send the presents. I'll hide my warlike side to me.
Even at the end, when I want to talk about the messianic vision that you get at the end, even at the end, he says, no, you go on ahead. After they've met and made up, and Esau says, hey, come back to Seir with me. He says, you go on ahead. I'll be there soon. And does he ever show up? Well, we'll see. But he hasn't quite come to grips, pun intended, right, with the fact that who he is meant to be is someone who is straight.
Well, the successful tactics of his life have been in, what's the word I'm looking for? In camouflage, in secrecy, in what the Russians call maskirovka,
yeah.
You know, in trickery.
And this is exactly what we were speaking about at the beginning, exactly why Am Yisrael today, we're struggling so hard to face the unescapable reality in my mind that there is no way to trick our way out of this. There's no way to slide through and dance between the raindrops anymore. At a certain point, we have to look inside ourselves and say, okay, wait, who are we really? If we really are Am Yisrael, then there is a straight way forward. If we're not, all the sort of dodging and weaving that we could possibly do at this point, the whirlwind is beginning to circle. And like you said, like whether it's up north in this like World War III scenario that's developing in Syria, or whether it's like in the streets here every single day where by the way, I don't know if it's just the jihad that's infecting these kids. Part of it, I feel like, is the hopelessness, not economic or cultural, the hopelessness that's spread even amongst kids in America, kids across the world. They don't know what's the future hold. It's going to be disaster. It's going to be environmental destruction. They lack vision. And when a child lacks vision, they're willing to lash out and do anything for their 5 minutes of fame. And life is easy to just consider it meaningless. I mean, think of the fact that these two girls that were shot just 500 meters away from here.
You're talking about two young Arab girls.
14 and 16.
Who were stabbing.
Who were hunting for someone to stab. And who do they find?
An old Arab.
A 7-year-old Arab man in the shuk. What, they're so stupid they couldn't find a Jew?
And they're stabbing with scissors.
With scissors. Like, what's going on there? That to me is not the jihad. I mean, it may be a little bit in their education. That to me is just the emptiness of their lives. And the desire
to—it's a little Columbine type of thing.
Yeah,
and there's been many Columbines since Columbine, but that's the one I remember.
And don't forget, these kids are digital natives. They live on the internet.
Right.
You know, your 5 minutes of fame is what's real.
Mm.
That is until you get shot. I'm sure that was pretty real.
And they got so shot too. It was another one of these.
Listen,
I saw the video. I was like, ugh, blah.
Yeah. Well, listen. At this point, Am Yisrael is aiming to kill as well.
Yeah, I'm happy to see that. I just want to say one thing about this knifing thing.
Mm-hmm.
In Hebrew and I think in other languages as well, knives is considered a cold weapon. Neshek kar, it's called,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to a gun, which has a firing mechanism, i.e., there's an explosion and fire. It's called
right.
Neshek ham.
Right.
But I think it's backwards. There's something very, very sterile yeah. about shooting.
Oh, for sure.
But knifing somebody, coming and sticking a knife in their flesh or a scissors.
It's an act of intimacy.
Mm.
It's an act of intimacy. And
gosh.
I feel like that in many ways, that's what everyone desires around here. We've been walking parallel lives with the Arabs around us for so long. And I think that that's what people want to fall. It's like, just see me. See that I exist. Okay, you don't have to like me or give me rights. Or that's like a different level of discussion, which a 14-year-old is not thinking
right.
about. I think a lot of it is just see me. You're going to pretend I don't exist? Watch this. Ha!
Right.
Now you know I exist.
Interesting. Yinon Magal, a Knesset member for the Beit Yehudi, who now is involved in some scandals, but interestingly enough, just before he got involved with these scandals, came up on the stage of the Knesset and gave a speech in Arabic, short mm-hmm. but 4-minute speech in Arabic. He read it from a paper. This is a Jewish Knesset member, and in it he said it all. He said, "This is, you cannot look away from us. We are going to stay here. We're going to stay in this land. You're not going to push us out. Forget those dreams of a Palestinian state. We're here to stay." And it was. He spoke in their language, and in one sense showed them that we're here. by not speaking our language that you could say, don't pay attention to these guys. This video went viral. It's been seen hundreds of thousands of times, and I think not just by Jews and Israelis. And you could see the Arab Knesset members at the Knesset just squirming in their chairs because he was addressing them, in a sense also saying, I will talk to you. I will talk to you. I'm going to get through the little barriers that you've put up to not see me. I want to be seen also by you. There's another side to it, which
for
is
sure.
Our cousins don't want to see us.
None of us want to see each other.
Right.
Because we're all living in this illusion that the other one's just going to go away and everything's going to be all right.
Okay, so there's another aspect that we haven't discussed here, which is that part of this transition between Jacob and Israel and coming to terms with your full identity is the coming back to the land of Israel.
This Torah is the essence of it,
right? He's leaving the Galut, Yaakov. He's coming. He has to face his fears, face his challenges, and as you were saying, Rabbi Mike Foyer on Spiritual Cafe here on the Yishai Fleischer Show in Jerusalem, as you were saying. He's still coming to terms with what tactics he uses to make it in this world. Is he just surviving through trickery, or is he being more overt and straightforward? Then comes the next great challenge, which is the daughter Dina. The daughter Dina, she goes into. She's a liberated digital native. Let's call it. She's a young girl, and she somehow goes out, and she gets captured by a kind of prince of the town of the city of Shechem, and she is somehow violated. And oftentimes when we see in the Torah a story of sexual violation, the male usually hates the victim. Here it's different. He actually falls in love with her. And the mystics are, again, the antenna of the mystics goes wild here about who these Gilgulim are. These are the, what are they called?
Reincarnations.
Reincarnations, and who they really stand for. But on a political, technical level, there's a rape that happens here, but he wants to marry her, Shechem. He wants to marry the daughter of Jacob. He wants to become part of this great... these great people that somehow he gets a taste of. The two sons of Yaakov, Shimon and Levi, kind of come to an agreement with Shechem and his town. They say, sure, join us. Yes, we'll be one. Nothing happened bad here. No hard feelings. But we do ask you that you, if you want to join our peoplehood and you want us to join your peoplehood, we have one important t'nai.
Condition,
and that is, please circumcise yourselves, because for us, you know, uncircumcised heathens is just unacceptable. Shechem surprisingly says, absolutely, I'd love it. What a great idea. Sure, you know, it's nothing. And he circumcises himself, and the whole town gets circumcised.
That must have been a tough sell.
And yet the Bible, the Torah, makes it look like everybody's like, sure, sounds great. Let's do that. And we're talking about a whole town of heathens. And as they circumcise themselves on the third day, when they're in their kind of weakest state, Shimon and Levi enter town with their swords, and they slaughter the whole town. And they take Dina, their sister, and they take booty out of the town. And then Yaakov is another great bind, and he just says, like, how could you have made me look so bad in the eyes of the world, in the eyes of our neighbors? And he finishes the line that answers him is Shimon and Levi says, "Would our sister be turned into a harlot?" End. Period. And you don't know what the Bible's perspective on this is. You don't really get to know. You do know that later on in the Torah they get punished, they get separated. The wrath is too much. But you can read it either way. Either they did something heroic or they did something that was out of bounds. And this is very much about the tools of war. Maybe they took it too far to the other side.
It's also classic biblical morality. I think people want simplistic morality out of the Bible. Let Yaakov tell them, good work. That's the way we should do to our enemies. Or let him tell them, no, this was wrong. You should never do this. Right? Instead, what happens? He says, how could you do such a thing? And they say, well, how could we not? And that's it. Because you know why? Because now you're going to be faced with reality. This is reality. We're in the same situation right now.
You know, and you know, there are certain things that we may be called upon to do, which are going to leave scars on ourselves and scars on our enemies and you know, and scars on our image in the world. And yet it's possible to say, nevertheless, this is what needs to be done. Because this is the task, I think, that Am Yisrael has in the world. See, the reason the West is unable to face up to the jihadis right now is because the West is convinced that being sure of anything is wrong. Because their history of 2,000 years of oppression is they've been killing each other 2,000 years over being sure over what they were sure of. The jihad, on the other hand, is in that sort of medieval state of mind where they're absolutely sure that they're right. The task of Am Yisrael is to be able to deal with the sort of muddiness of moral complexity and still move forward. Right? We're not just going to buy into the difficulty and say, well, therefore you can't act. We're also not going to sell ourselves short and say, well, I'm just going to convince myself that I'm always right. We're going to hold the difficulty. Yaakov says, how could you do such a thing? And brothers say, well, how could we not? And Yaakov is smart enough not to answer. Because he realizes, you know what? That there's no absolute answer to that situation.
This story is one that the analysis of which divides people very much.
Mm-hmm.
On the liberal side of the Jewish perspective, this is a horrific story, and they see Yaakov as saying, like, how could you have, you know, really done this thing and also ruined our reputation? And after the Holocaust, what we've been through, how could we do such a thing? You know, it's you hear that voice. But on the other hand, the more kind of right wing side of the Jewish thinking says, you see, this is the only way. You know, they were doing a Holocaust on us. They took our sister. They raped her. They wanted to destroy us, and we destroyed them. And a lot of people don't really, a lot of people on the right wing side don't really understand why Yaakov seems so upset.
Mm-hmm.
They did do a very bad thing to his daughter. And such is not to be done. The Bible narrative, kind of the narrator of the Bible, says that such should not be done. And I have heard in my many years of talking with people about this issue, I've heard one explanation of really what was very much bothering Yaakov, which I remember to this day. And it's not only the killing and the mass killing and all that kind of stuff, because maybe there was justification for that. But maybe, according to this explanation, the one thing he didn't like was the usage of the circumcision and the join us, meaning to say the trickery went to the place of join us and become a people of God and circumcise yourself and become holy like us and then to kill people. That's wrong. If you want to do a straight out war with these people because they did something wrong, fine. But don't invoke holiness and goodness and raise them up to the level of sanctity in order to use that religious and godly principle as a mechanism to undermine them. That one, that's a chilul Hashem.
Well, I that really speaks to me, because I'm feeling a lot of empathy for Yaakov as a father right now. Because what I hear in that is that when Yaakov was confronted with his son's behavior, which had a certain moral clarity and perhaps a necessity, but that the method was bound up with such trickery, he felt it was wrong, and yet he was unable to call it as such. Why? Because he knew where did they learn it from. This was his primary internal challenge,
right?
Was his inability to just say to his brother, listen, this is the way it's going to be. Or to say to the world, listen, this is the way it's going to be. And instead, he spent his whole life doing that end run. And now when he sees his sons doing it, he knows it's wrong, but he's unable to make a definitive statement. That's really powerful.
And the wrongness may be that you can't use... When it comes to morality, you can't use God's name in vain. It's taking God's thing in vain.
If you're going to do such a definitive horrific act, the only redeeming aspect of it is in the long run if it creates a moral clarity.
Right, right. And yet, interestingly enough, the Bible says that when they left to the third part of this Torah portion, when the sons of Jacob, the whole kind of tribe, is moving, there was a fear that came over the towns around the Jews.
Well, you know the joke about that.
What's that?
Well, I've been holding back, but you know, knew why nobody cared that they'd kill the entire town? Because once they'd been circumcised, they were Jewish. Sorry.
Nyak. He leaves town, and now that he's gone, Yaakov is now coming to really finish. He's got steps. This whole Torah portion is about steps.
Absolutely.
To come back to the land of Israel. face Esav. Deal with a new method of warfare that your children already of a different generation. The next one is come back to Beit El. Come back to this place where you had this incredible romantic moment with God, this face-to-face. And when I say face-to-face, that's a Midrashic thought as well. They really saw, you know, the angels saw on the ground, I'm talking about the dream of the ladder, those angels going up and down were amazed at the fact that they saw in the heavens the same face sitting on the throne as the face down below. Somehow the face of Yaakov is also somehow the face of God. And they had this incredible moment in Beit El. By the way, the other forefathers never came to Beit El. Not Avram. Avram, people misconstrue. He came close. Bein Ayu, Bein Beit El.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody comes to Beit El. Beit El is the place where Yaakov has his place of communion. And now, after he's been away for so long, he's going to come back to that very same place, like a salmon, going to come back to that very same place. By the way, you're laughing, but they say that the Baal Shem Tov ate salmon specifically for this reason, because of this idea of coming back home, that they're always homing back to where they're from.
That's because his salmon weren't farmed.
Right, his salmon were not farmed. And here comes Yaakov to this place, to Beit El, and here he's going to get the official crowning as his new name. Before, it was a sneak preview in the wrestling match. Now he's going to get the official crowning. You have now a new identity. Welcome back. I called you from Beit El in the Galut, in the diaspora. Anochi El Beit El. We learned in last week's Torah portion. Now he's going to show up to this place, and he's going to have that communion with God in the very place that he left from. I think this is an incredibly emotional moment. As a person who has lived in Beit El, I know that this there's something very meaningful in that there was a ping. Oh, we didn't talk about this last week. There was a ping that went out from the God of Beit El who said, come back to the land. I'm calling you back to this place. And there's no other verses in the Bible that God binds himself with a certain place.
Mm-hmm.
It says, Anochi El Beit El. Remember that thing that happened last time when you were here 20 years ago? I'm calling you back. Come back. And here he is. He's going to touch home. He's going to touch base. Come back to that place where he was poor and broken. Now he's coming back rich with a family. And he's going to honor God that was with him in all these dark years.
And I'm fascinated. I mean, he said this crowning of his new name, his new identity. And yet Yaakov is the only person in the entire Bible for whom his name change does not stick.
Right. Well, it does not stick. It's not a full-on name change.
Well, okay, that's a different way of saying it. My point is that when God changes Avraham's name, he becomes Avraham
right.
forever. When God changes Yehoshua's name, he becomes Yehoshua forever. When God changes Yaakov's name, he actually becomes two people.
Right.
I mean, to the point where when the latter prophets speak about him, sometimes he's Yaakov, sometimes he's Yisrael.
Right.
And I think that's because that he is the completion of this process of the Avot. Of the forefathers, that each of the forefathers represent a certain stage of development of Am Yisrael, of the people, and a certain stage of development in divine service. And Yaakov represents that stage of development, which is now you have to realize that you will always live within the tension of who you are and who you envision yourself to be. And if you're able to be honest in that, Yaakov is every man. Right? And the reality is, as an individual, as a normal person, I take whatever path is available to me when I'm trying to reach my goal. Yisrael is the ideal we all have of what we can be, perhaps even what we should be, right? And he struggles so much to be that, to the point where, like, sometimes in the same sentence, he'll be Yaakov and Yisrael. And God willing, when we get to the end of the book of Genesis, we'll see when he's speaking to his sons and he wants to give over that final vision of what is, he calls himself Yisrael and the Bible calls him Yaakov. He wants to give over to his children, like we all do, the ideal vision of who we are and not perhaps the mess of reality. And yet, and this is why I think it's here, what you said, and yet you can't avoid the mess of reality because that's actually where God calls you from. God does never call you from your ideal. Because if we lived our ideal life, we couldn't have offer anything to God. If we were perfect and divine, God wouldn't need us. It's the land and its messiness, its groundedness, its embodiment, all the problems and the moral complexities and the failures, that's what we have to offer to God. And that's why ultimately God calls him from El Beit El.
The transition between Yaakov and Israel in the way you're explaining it is a kind of constant where we're like, we're Yaakov and we're always yearning to get to that completion stage of Yisrael.
And sometimes we touch it.
Right.
Sometimes we express that in our actions.
Right. And sometimes we go back deep into galut, exilic thinking.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And yet that's why the messianic vision is one of becoming Yisrael.
To me, it's very, very Clark Kent and Superman. You know, Yaakov is Clark Kent. Clark Kent, by the way, is he seems like a klutz, but he's faking it. He's a little bit tricky. Mm-hmm. It's actually not real.
It's a cover.
It's a cover. But he bumps in, he's klutzy. It's a fake, mm-hmm. right? And that's a little bit Yaakov. He's a little like, oh, look at me, I'm making a yummy soup. Want some soup? You know, just give me the birthright. It's trickery. It's fakeness a little bit, but it's a survival method. But to emerge as the Malchut, the kingdom of Israel, is the distance between exile and coming into the land of Israel.
You know, it's funny. I don't want to carry your metaphor too far, but it speaks to me because Clark Kent is also a reporter, right?
Right.
He's not making anything happen. He's just telling the story.
Right.
Right. Superman is the one who steps in and makes it happen.
Right.
And in so many ways, that's the difference between being in exile and being in our land. Okay. You know, I've told you the story about my brother and the 20th terrorist at 9/11. So my brother, he should be healthy and well, writes for the New York Times. And he was in the Brooklyn courts when after 9/11. You know, there was a 20th terrorist. Right, his alarm clock didn't go off or something. He literally like woke up, realized, oh, I missed the plane, you know? So thank God they tracked him down. It was one of the ways they unraveled the whole story. So my brother is sitting there in the press box at the Brooklyn courts when they bring in the 20th terrorist just for an arraignment. Technical court, they're going to give his charge. He'll make his plea, take him out. Except it happened to be on Ash Wednesday.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's really true that most of the prosecutors in the Brooklyn courts are Irish Catholic.
Okay.
So Catholics on Ash Wednesday, they take communion in the morning, and the priest puts an ash cross on their forehead, and their tradition is they don't wipe it off.
Oh, my gosh.
So now here comes this guy, this terrorist, who was raised in a culture where they actually cut your head off for things and has been taught that America is a crusader state, right, that is attempting to take over the world. They bring him out. He looks. He sees a bunch of white guys in suits with ash crosses on their foreheads, freaks out. He starts to run the bailiffs. He's handcuffed. The bailiffs don't know what's going on. They think what he's going to go. He's going to please. He's going to walk out. They have to like tackle him. Nobody knows. It's pandemonium in the courthouse. My brother's sitting in the press box. He sees it all in one instant. All like that. Wow. And he says to me, and the Jew's in the corner writing the story.
That's funny. That the only thing I can compare that to is that this past Sukkot, there was the blood moon that everybody mm-hmm. was talking about.
And sure.
My wife woke me up. The baby woke up my wife. My wife woke me up. I go outside to my sukkah. I was sleeping in the other sukkah. Nobody should have any doubts. There was two sukkot. I was sleeping in the back sukkah, but my wife woke me up, and I went to the front sukkah, and there was this giant moon. It was a super moon, and it's being covered by the shadow of the earth. And basically, it's a lunar eclipse, and it's red and all that, blood moon. I call it the molasses moon because it was so darn slow. But in any case, as this red blood moon is happening, there I'm on the Mount of Olives. I see to my right on the top of the Mount of Olives, the Christians are baying at it. Hallelujah! And they're blowing the shofar. Doo, 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 doo. And it's exactly at sunrise. At dawn, and the mosques all go off at the same time. Allahu Akbar. And they're like, Hallelujah, do, 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 do. Allahu Akbar. It's all going on. The blood moon is that. And I look around and I see all the Sukkot of the Jews, and the Jews are like,
sound asleep.
Whatever. It was really something else. It was really quite a sight. Quite a sight. All right. Now, coming to the land of Israel also means saying hello and saying goodbye. You're going to come back to the place where you haven't been in 20 years. And at the end of the Torah portion, he's going to go to Hebron, where I'm working these days to try to make it into an awesome World Heritage Site. And he's going to say hi to his father. He's going to see his father. But before that, he's going to say goodbye to the women that he loves. He's going to say goodbye in a hidden fashion to his mom, Rivka, her handmaiden, Dvorah Me'aneket Rivka, her nursemaid, who has been with him on this journey all this time, somehow passes away and is buried in Beit El. Our rabbis tell us that this is a metaphor for the passing of his mom. And that's not the only burial. The other burial is of his beloved wife, Rachel Imenu, who dies on the way. She dies on the way. She doesn't make it to the burial plot in Hebron. She doesn't make it there. She's on the way. She's on the way. He buries her in a plot in Beit Lechem, which is later going to become the seat of the Davidic dynasty. And he's going to put a burial, a mausoleum of sorts, that is going to be for eternity, for Jewish history, a place of prayer and a place of tears. And because this Jewish mom, Rachel, refuses to be consoled, she cries for her children to come back to the land of Israel. In the meantime, the way she dies is that the first Sabra is born, the first young tribes member, the first next generation of Israelis is born. He's born with sandals and a triangular kovat temple hat. No, maybe not, but he is something else, and he is Benjamin, and he's born in the land of Israel. And as he's born, and this new generation of Israelis, of Jews in the land of Israel, these strong Jews are born, that story of the diaspora, Rachel dies. She his beloved wife dies, and he cannot bring her all the way. Interestingly enough, he himself later on in life is going to be mummified and kept a long time, 40 days, until he's finally buried. But no, Rachel Imenu had to be buried somehow immediately where she died, on the road to Ephrat, in a town called Beit Lechem, on the way really towards Hebron, as they kind of enter the land of Israel. So, you know, I don't know what to say. She's the one mom. She's the one, she is not buried with the rest. She is alone. I have to add one more addendum. The tomb of Rachel today is in Galut by itself.
It's a fortress.
It's a fortress that has been put in exile. Exile has surrounded it.
Mm-hmm. You know, in many ways, Rachel is Yaakov's wife.
Right.
Whereas Leah is Yisrael's. And you said so nicely that Rachel is buried along the way. In the same way that Yaakov is always in process, and to the point where that the sages teach us in the Gemara and Tanit that Yaakov, you know, lo met. Yaakov never dies.
The Bible never says that he dies.
Right. He never dies, and because in that sense he represents the eternal process. Right? Whereas Yisrael is the goal, and he's buried there in the tomb of the patriarchs in Maarat HaMachpelah with Leah, and they represent the ideal. And so her commitment to the fact that just like she was buried along the way, that her children, we, will need her tears in support for the long, long journey, right? And as people who have merited, actually at least take the next step in that journey in coming home to the land of Israel, but are also, I think, conscious enough to know that that's not enough, that that's the next step in the journey, but there are many others to make in terms of building society which we truly want to live in, and returning the heart to our society and the temple, and beginning to shine that light outwards. I feel tremendous closeness and sadness every time I go to the tomb of Rachel and have to pass through literally 20-foot high concrete barriers and checkpoints and soldiers, and basically only because of the absolute personal insistence of one man that it was included. It wasn't actually on the other side of that wall, and it be part of the, you know, the Palestinian Authority there in Beit Lechem. You know that story?
Sure.
That Rechavam Zevi.
No, it was. They were sitting together. But it was actually Menachem Porush, Menachem or his father. I forgot which one's the dad. The Porush. He started. He was. They were talking with Rabin about the tomb of Rachel, and Zevi was explaining this can be part of Jerusalem. It's not a problem. But Porush starts crying, and he like cries tears, and he goes, "Mama Rochel, Mama Rochel." And Rabin's like, "All right," and he like
draws a little loop in the line.
But you know. But though it is included in municipal Jerusalem and kind of in Israel, it is in exile. The place has become exiled from Jewish consciousness. It's in Butner, North Carolina. You know,
just think about the metaphor.
Do you know what I mean by that? That's the Pollard prison.
Yeah, yeah.
By the way, we I don't know if we mentioned this. Jonathan Pollard, he's free-ish.
Listen, he's out of jail.
He's out of jail.
He's out of jail.
And he's in New York City.
He's in New York City, which has got to be a big change. A lot of Jews there. But I want to finish that thought. It's an important one.
Because we're thinking about, you know, it's these processes of leaving diaspora and somehow we'll come back to the land of Israel and the tomb of Rachel has become in diaspora. Somehow Jonathan Pollard, after 30 years, also like a biblical type story, is now out of prison. But
I think that the parallel between Rachel's tomb and the Temple Mount is very important to draw here. Why? Because, you know, if you approached Rachel's tomb and you didn't know it was there, you saw the towers, literally the towers, and the 20-foot-high concrete barriers and the armed guards. What would you assume was on the inside?
Prison.
Prison or something extremely dangerous or, you know, something so precious that it needed to be so guarded. You get in there, you say, what? It's a tomb?
Of a lady?
Of a lady? Why does everybody want to get in there?
From 3,500 years ago?
Yeah, why does everybody want to get in there? And you know what the answer is? Because they want to pray. They want to pray. In the same way, why are the Muslims, if a Jew on the Temple Mount goes to cover his eyes because he's going to sneeze, the police all but tackle him and drag him off the Temple Mount. And the Muslims are cheering and screaming at him. Like, why? Like, what's the big deal if I go up there and pray? Because the thing that they're trying to teach us is something that we ought to know about ourselves, which is our power of prayer is actually the most precious power we have. And it can change the world. And I see that fortress there built by a government which doesn't actually believe so much in the power of prayer. And the prevention of Jews to pray in our holiest site, the only place in the world where we'll say, oh, sorry, you're a Jew, you can't pray here. Right? It's because deep inside these forces recognize that if we actually were B'nai Yisrael, the children of Israel, and were able to summon up that prayerful vision of what the world could be and what we ought to be in it, so the world would change. And people are afraid of that.
And it's the tomb of the forefathers and mothers in Hebron, the tomb of Rachel in Bethlehem, Beit Lechem, the Temple Mount, and the tomb of Joseph.
Which is in ashes.
Just destroyed.
Right.
Although recently rebuilt.
Yeah, well.
And who knows how long that'll
last. If we don't own it.
Yeah. It's then, destroyed.
Yeah.
And these are the places. And this, for me, this has been part of my life's work. And now, thank God, I'm excited to be actually involved in this in the stuff of this issue.
I'm so excited that you're doing it.
You know, how bring it back to our consciousness and own it and love it and love these places. By the way, all of our holy places are burial spots except for the Temple Mount.
Right.
All of them are these are this is our history. This is our national narrative. This is the connection to God. In any case. Rachel Imenu passes away. Binyamin is born, and then finally, it's the story of Esav himself and his kind of history. And the Bible does not spare ink. The Torah does not spare ink to tell us about Esav. Why is that? Why is there so many? What's the tale of Esav so important for us?
Well, you know, the sages have a principle that there's not one wasted word in the entire Torah.
Sure.
And so therefore they go at length to find
By the way, that's not just a rabbinic principle. That's just obvious to anybody who reads the Hebrew text understands that the Torah's words are
precious.
Right.
Listen, but at the same time I would say that one's assumptions will define one's conclusions, right? Meaning if you value and honor this text and say, surely it's not a wasted word, it will open up worlds for you. If you look at it and say, well, listen, they just had to, you know, they had to give the list, so then it will be a closed book to you, right?
And I agree with you, but I just want you to know that for me, it came, in my life, it came exactly the opposite.
What do you mean?
I came to religion, to God, because I looked at this book and it became just obvious to me very quickly that this is not written by man. And that every word is precious. That came to me as an initial conclusion.
As an insight.
And then later on, I learned the rest of the stuff. But
that's
it was just
beautiful.
Like if you and that's why I find that most people that have heretical thoughts usually don't read Hebrew well. Mm. And they're not linguistic and attuned to text. Because if you are, you see very quickly that like whoa, we're dealing with how should I say. Not a regular book. This is you know what I mean. The secrets, the depth of it. It's not written by man. It's got secrets in every single verse. It's got truths in every verse. It's not one extra wasted word. And that's why I'm asking you, Rabbi Mike Foyer, why tell us so much about the story of Esav?
So I mean, there's a lot there, but I think on a simple level, it is a reiteration of the relationship between Esav and Yaakov.
Esav is literally born first. Yaakov comes after and takes the birthright. Right? He's the one who is physically born in the world second, but we say was actually intended to be primary. In the same way, what the Bible is doing now is laying out for us, this is what Esav's society will be. They're going to bring kingship into the world first. They're shaping the world. They're shaping the world in order that was, so that its purpose can emerge. And its purpose will be in the kingship of Israel. And therefore, look, the shaping of the world is quite a detailed and intensive process.
So Esav is going to shape the world, but the spirit is going to be put in by Yaakov. But you have to also take the world by the reins and become a little Esavian. At the end of times, Yaakov has to know how to be a little bit Esavian. We met that twice, really. Once with Yaakov's voice having to also have the hands of Esav.
Mm-hmm.
And the second time when we learned that that the latter had its head in the skies but its feet on the ground.
Absolutely.
You've got to know how to grab this world a little bit by the horns and be a little bit more Esavian. And Esav, at the end, or really like the Rome or Yafet, will emulate or help the aesthetics of this world match the spiritual meaning of it.
So I think we see this in the messianic prophecy that's actually hidden in our Torah portion. That, you know, like I said, Yaakov is this kind of like the trickster, the deceiver, and he's struggling to be this straight arrow kind of guy, Yisrael. And the last interaction he has with Esav is when Esav says, look, I'll go slow. We can walk back to Seir together. And Yaakov says, no, you go on ahead. I'll meet you there. So Rashi picks up and says, wait a minute. Was he lying to Esav? We don't see that he went to meet him. Now, by the way, would this be a surprise if he'd been lying to Esav? He's lied to him before. And what Rashi is reflecting, I believe, is the fact, isn't he Israel now? Isn't he the straight shooter? He says, no, when will Yaakov actually come to fulfill that promise? V'alu Moshim b'har Tzion lishpot et har Esav, right? When it says in the prophet that when the saviors will come up on the Mount of Zion and they'll judge the Mount of Esav, that's when Yaakov is going to be able to speak straight finally to Esav. After this building, after Esav's world is complete and Yaakov is able to own who he is Israel, he's going to stand up on Mount Zion and he's going to do judgments. And judgments, that's a very strong, assertive stance. And it's only then that they're going to be able to live together.
So we are awaiting the messianic period. Certainly, we're in the process. We're in the birth canal. There's blood, and there's pain. Contractions. We're living in the time of contractions right now. No question about it. These are the birth pangs of Mashiach. If you don't know it, know it. There's no doubt about it, and it's not a simple process. And we hope to God that we'll be able to see it go all the way through. If not us, then if we're not going to see it with these fleshly eyes, we'll see it another way. But certainly our job is to be a link on the chain, pass that baton, and teach our children and prepare the world as much as we can in our short lifespan for this birth to emerge. Rabbi Mike Forer, I want to thank Jack, who really made the show possible today, and he's dedicating today's show to his sister Sarah and his wife Lillian, who he blesses to have a path of spirituality guided by Hashem and strength. And I guess that blessing also goes for all of us out there. So I want to thank you very much, Jack. I want to bless you, your family, and I want to bless all of you out there for being part of the program. We are broadcasting from Jerusalem, Beit Midrash Sulam Yaakov with Rabbi Mike Forer. Also, please check out Sulam Yaakov has their own audio list, which has fantastic Torah shiurim. I'll get you that website, but if you want to know about that, do you have a website?
We have sulamyaakov.com.
Sulamyaakov.com.
You can find us also on SoundCloud and on iTunes, Sounds of Sulam Yaakov.
Sounds of Sulam Yaakov. I highly recommend it. I listen to it myself. It makes my life richer and more tuned in to what's happening really all around us. I want to thank you, and I want you to write me an email, show@yishaifleischer.com or yishaifleischer@gmail.com if you forget. And wherever you are out there, stay connected, stay tuned, and stay strong. And we're going to keep you connected. So come on back and shalom. Yeah.
שלנו הוא השמש.